Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club, and I'm your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Moss Spray Controversy Update, partnerships between, I can't remember all the whole name, but it is all about partnerships. Our moderator tonight is Christy Dames. Christy is the CEO and founder of Tech Talk Studio and also very active in helping families and children with their healthcare initiatives and healthcare challenges. I would like to ask Unique Phillips to just stand up for a minute, please. And Unique is the lady over here. Unique was our co-producer on this event and has been instrumental in bringing the panel together. And I really want to thank her with a round of applause right now. Our other co-producer is our moderator tonight, and that is Christy Dames. I'd like to introduce her right now.
Thanks, Kevin. Hi, everybody. I'm really glad that you're all here. We have a really incredible group of four experts, each in different fields, to talk about this issue and also to talk about not just the LBAM light brown apple moth, but also to talk about pesticides and groups of people that have come together that are now in partnership that weren't before. They didn't know that this was an issue. And so we want to explore this from a couple of different vantage points and from the leadership perspective, too, because we have four leaders here who are doing some really important work. And I like to think that where we go in California is where the rest of the country is going to have to go. We're going to have to make them go there. So welcome. I'm really glad you're here. I got involved in this about 2 years ago, and I remember the day that I found out about it, and it was like I got a sucker punch to the head. And I've been helping families and children who have severe neurological illness for a long time. And I couldn't believe at that time that somebody was going to take planes, and they were going to fly over my house, and they were going to spray pesticides over me. And it was just incomprehensible to me that this could be. And when I see all the children that I was dealing with and working with who were already immune compromised and compromised in more ways than I could count, this was going to be that burden that could literally mean for them they may not ever recover. So I got really personally involved. I sent emails out to the moms and women's list that I know. And I had a new partnership form with a woman, and it was completely, I didn't expect that this woman and I would become partners in this. And this is a woman who had a business. She sold her business. She has a home in Atherton. She has a home in San Francisco. And she just became an activist advocate like I have never seen. And I realized at that moment that do not tell a mom you're going to spray her kids. Do not do that. And this woman and I have become really good friends. But most importantly, I saw people that I may have thought would not take up the gauntlet to go do something and fight for something. And people from all over rise to an occasion. And I had not seen that. So these four folks that are here with us today have very personal stories. They have from the front line stories. They have stories from way behind the line as well. So what we're going to do tonight is I'm going to introduce each one, and Caroline is who I'm going to start with, and she's going to give us kind of an update, actually, of where we are now, briefly. And then we're going to start into some questions and talk about the partnerships that are arising. And then we'll welcome your questions as well. We have a mic over here, so we'll do some Q&A probably in about 35 minutes or so and go from there. So I'd like to introduce first Caroline Cox. And Caroline leads the Center for Environmental Health Research on Toxic Exposures, identifying, analyzing, and substantiating the scientific bases for CEH's work to eliminate threats to children and others exposed to dangerous chemicals in consumer products. Previously, she worked for 16 years as staff scientist at the Northwest Coalition for Alternatives to Pesticides in Oregon. She was also editor of NCAP's Journal of Pesticide Reform. Caroline represents CEH on the Steering Committee of Californians for Pesticide Reform and currently serves as a public interest representative to the U.S. EPA's Pesticide Program Dialogue Committee. She also serves on the board of directors of Beyond Pesticides, and Caroline has a master's degree in entomology from Oregon State University, and I'm really happy to have you here. Caroline, could you just start by telling us from where we started on this little light brown apple moth and all the issues that have ensued, can you give us the update where we are today with what's actually still going on and maybe what's changed?
So probably most of you remember, even if you haven't been following this issue in all of its twists and turns, that in the fall of 2007, the California Department of Food and Agriculture started what they called at that time an eradication program. And they began by doing an aerial spray program in Monterey and Santa Cruz. And they announced plans to expand that aerial spray program basically throughout the Bay Area. There was a huge amount of controversy that ensued, and I think we'll hear more about that as this program proceeds. Eventually, CDFA pretty much pulled the plug on the aerial spray part of the program. They also, because of some very clever legal work, were forced to do an environmental impact report about the program. And that report was actually just completed and released a couple of months ago. So we now have kind of a picture of what's being planned for the future, although the report can be frustratingly short on details. But several things have happened. One is that the treatment area has expanded from the Bay Area to now it covers almost the entire state. The second thing is, after listening to many people tell CDFA that eradication was impossible, that there were too many of these moths in California and they'd been here too long, CDFA has officially said that it's not an eradication program, it's a control program. And I think the important thing to know about that is that that means that there is no end. It goes on forever. And then just to talk briefly about the pesticides that are included in the environmental impact report that will be used as this program proceeds. The pheromones, which were used in the 2007 spring, are still part of the program. There's some different ways of applying them, and CDFA has said that they won't use aerial spraying technique in populated areas, although it's a little fuzzy how that's defined. And the other two chemicals that seem to have kind of risen to the top in this environmental impact report are Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a bacteria that makes insects sick, and spinosad, which is an insecticide. And all three of these products are things which, in one form or another, can be used in organic production, although not necessarily in the way that they're planned to be used in the apple moth program. I wanted to talk for just a couple minutes about sort of what we know about these chemicals and what we don't know.
Excuse me, Carol, before we do that, let's get back to that in one
okay.
second, because I would love to go there, but I just want to make sure everybody gets introduced first,
okay.
if we could do that. The second panelist I'd like to introduce is the gentleman right here who can't look at me, Roy Upton. And Roy is the LBAM liaison for Citizens for Health, a citizens advocacy organization with 87,000 members nationwide. He has been involved with the LBAM since its discovery in California and has authored and or co-authored numerous scientific reviews on the human, animal, and environmental impacts of LBAM pesticide program. Roy was the lead author of a seminal scientific petition calling for the reclassification of the light brown apple moth. And Roy, what I'd like to ask you, if you could just start, What was it that stimulated your interest in this LBAM issue?
Great question. It's very passionate for me. I actually was hiking down in Elkhorn Slough. Elkhorn Slough is a marine sanctuary, part of a marine sanctuary down in Santa Cruz and Aptos by Watsonville. And my real work is herbal medicine, and I was looking at plants down there. And right along the shore, there were about 35 dead cormorants, and all in pristine condition. Now, usually when you see a roadkill or you see a dead bird, it's rotten, it's eaten by maggots or flies, and they were just all in pristine condition. I'm thinking, what the heck could have killed these birds? I didn't think twice. You know, I left it at that, didn't think twice about it. Then we got sprayed in Santa Cruz, and the day after we got sprayed Thursday night, and Friday morning, my eyes are scratchy, my throat's scratchy, and it was a different type of scratch. It wasn't a cold or a flu-type scratchiness. It was just strange, and I'm thinking, geez, I wonder if it was that spray stuff. I mean, I grew up in Boston. We used to run behind the pesticide trucks spraying DDT, right? So I don't have thin skin. I'm pretty thick-skinned about this stuff. But I said, I wonder if it's this spray that they did last night that caused this. And then I started reading about reports from adverse events reported by people in Monterey who were sprayed before us, right around the time when I saw the dead birds. And I said, son of a gun, I wonder if that's the same stuff. You know, they were reporting scratchy eyes, scratchy nose, irritated throat, weird respiratory stuff. And then Saturday hit, and people walking down Seacliff Beach with their kids and their dogs, literally out in the water, were birds flapping, not being able to maintain their buoyancy, and literally drowning by the droves, not being able to make it to shore because they had this thick coating of yellow-green slime on them, literally drowning in front of your eyes. Usually, we went to Native Animal Rescue, and they said, we've never seen anything like this. In the first 2 days, we've had 235 birds submitted to us. This has never happened in our 30 years of wildlife rescue. And the birds were covered with this slime. We got sprayed Thursday night. Friday, we had a little bit of rain. Saturday, we had a torrential downpour. Saturday morning and Sunday morning, the whole coastline was covered with this yellow-green slime, which we later found out was the microcaps, which they sprayed because people in our coalition, they took water samples. They looked at it under the microscope. San Jose University saw the microcaps. Other people took the scrapings off of their windshields. Same thing. They saw the microcaps. We talked to people in the neighborhood that had planter boxes, their decks, their cars covered with the same green, yellow slime. I was saying, son of a gun, this is what killed those birds too, likely. I can't say that for sure. But that's what stimulated my interest in this. And from that moment, what I do in the world of herbal medicine is try to help separate the scientific wheat from marketing chaff. Well, I took the same approach to LBAM. Is the moth a real problem, first off? What is the safety or potential toxicity of the stuff they're spraying? And is there a better way? Because what Carol didn't tell you was they planned on doing this 3 days every month for up to 7 years and maybe up to 15 years throughout the entire Bay Area for something they never even looked at the science on. And so that's what fired me up. That answers your question.
Thank you, Roy. Yes. I'm going to shift gears a little bit, and I'm going to introduce Preston Mehring, and we're going to also talk a little bit about food. Chris is also in the food industry. So Dr. Preston Mehring is the Associate Physician-in-Chief at the Kaiser Permanente East Bay Medical Center in Oakland. In 2003, he started a farmer's market at his hospital. And there are now markets at multiple Kaiser Permanente facilities in 5 states, making healthy food available for many, which support Kaiser Permanente's preventative health message in the communities it serves. And so, separate from the LBAM issue, we're talking about health and children's health, families' health, and even, as you mentioned to me, farm workers' health. And so I'd like to hear about how you came to this issue.
I've been at Kaiser Permanente for 40 years practicing primary care medicine. It's been clear to me that one of the most important determinants for someone's health is what they eat. And what I brought together in 2003 at the all-organic market of my medical center was just a way to put a fresh peach in front of someone in the middle of July or fresh asparagus in spring after it finally sprouted when the ground warmed up in Fresno, and figured that perhaps by putting good food in front of people, we can make the switch from eating so many things with O's in it, like Cheetos and Fritos and Doritos, and move more toward good, healthy food. Now, our market was an all-organic market at my hospital. I just wanted to keep it that way. But I also recognized that just the step from eating processed foods and packaged foods to a fresh green salad, however it was grown, was the first important step. And then the next step is to take the opportunity when it arises to say, well, you know, if you're going to buy strawberries, you're going to spend a little extra here and there. Maybe you think about the impact of how your food is grown, because really, as you vote with your fork, you're really affecting more than just you, more than just your children, and more than just the earth. You're also affecting the people that grow your food. And I took increasing interest in that as I got to know the farmers. When I got to know about them, and I got to know about their children, and I got to know about their grandchildren, because I had the privilege of having them outside of my hospital, I began to get interested in how the choices we make affect them. One of my farmers, I call it my farmer, I feel an ownership about the market of my hospital. I mean, there are, as you mentioned, we have 38 markets at Kaiser Permanente facilities around the country. There are markets now at other healthcare systems, Vanderbilt, Johns Hopkins, UCSF, up at Yale, New Haven is getting a market started July 9th. So the concept is spreading. But, you know, when you have a market at your place and you take some ownership for it, you get to know the people. I got a chance to talk to a farmer by the name of Mr. Roberto Rodriguez, who grows strawberries in Watsonville. We had 35 acres of conventional strawberries. 8 years ago, he had a daughter. He did not want his daughter playing in a field where pesticides were used. He started making the transition to organic berries. He now has about half of his acreage in organic strawberries. And in a recent season, he sold 130 dozen pints of strawberries every week to our institution alone of his organic berries, which allowed him to hire 5 new farm workers. Now, that's, and I asked him, I said, well, if you've got 16 acres of organic berries, what about all 35? And he said, there is not enough demand yet for all 35 of my acres to be organic. I have to keep half of it in conventional berries so that I can keep my farm workers busy for the whole, you know, 7 days a week, which is what they want to be. His farm workers want to be busy. We have the chance to create a future every time we pick up our fork, to have all 35 acres of Roberto Rodriguez's strawberries be grown in a way that's not only good for us, but it's also good for his farm workers and the children of the farm workers who are impacted by the pesticides and things that get used on their products. So I come at this issue tonight from a much more broad sense, and have learned that what happens with LBAM has a direct impact on individual farmers, and we'll hear more about that from my colleague here, and that ultimately affects the downstream supply for institutions like ours and for individuals and other healthcare institutions around that are really increasing their use of sustainable ag.
Thank you, Preston. Now, I love the vote with our fork. Mm-hmm. Michael Pollan just came out with a new book, and I heard last night that one of his ideas, or one of the things he tells people to do, is don't eat anything that comes through your car window. So that's one of his rules, his practical rules. Don't eat anything coming through your car window. I'd like to introduce Chris Mittelstadt. And Chris is the founder and CEO of The Fruit Guys, the industry leader in providing farm-fresh produce to the American workplace. Bringing healthy brain food to the office can boost productivity, improve wellness, and help companies improve their bottom line. What started out as a two-person operation and an old Honda filled with fruit has become a multi-million dollar enterprise that supports many small farmers and employs over 30 staff. Chris is the co-founder of the steering committee for Shape Up San Francisco, Mayor Gavin Newsom's initiative to help San Franciscans move more and eat healthier. Chris is also a former chair and an active member of the Worksite Wellness Committee for the California Task Force on Youth and Workplace Wellness. So part of what Chris does, he's this beautiful person that sits in the middle between farmers and what's happening here and people eating that produce, and works in tandem there, and then speaks out for all of those people as well. So, Chris, how is it that you came to this issue? Did you come to the issue first? Did Fruit Guys come for? How did you arrive here?
We heard about this issue when it first came up a little bit from some of our farmers. I also live in San Francisco, so we're aware of it because, you know, I have three kids here and I live in the city, and I was not interested in being sprayed as well. But it really hit home for me last year. We had been involved, but it really came home for me when a farmer of ours up in Aptos, California, near Santa Cruz. He's a young guy. His name's Greg, and he has a farm called Blue Moon Organics. And he's got 7.5 acres of organic strawberries. And we buy his berries, we buy some of his vegetables, and we put them in our mixes, whether they're for companies or for individuals. And last year, in about June of 2009, Greg had a CDFA inspector come on site, and they found a caterpillar, a couple of caterpillars, in about 3.5 acres of his 7-acre strawberry fields there. And although they couldn't immediately classify it as a light brown apple moth, because the CDFA, the California Department of Food and Ag, has a policy right now that if they have any inkling that this may be a light brown apple moth, they immediately quarantine the farm. Greg was shut down for his 3.5, that part of his farm was shut down. Now, you have to remember, this is a small farmer with a very small amount of land. And for somebody to lose half of their ag production, even for, you know, a couple of days or weeks, can really impact whether or not they can be a sustainable farm from an economic standpoint. So they told him that, okay, it's going to take 10 days to identify this caterpillar. We'll get back to you, and then we'll let you know whether you can release your product or not. Turns out it took 3.5, almost 4 weeks until they were able to identify this. They came back to him, and they said, well, actually, you know, this isn't light brown apple moth. But while we were here telling you this, we found in your other 3.5 acres, we found some more caterpillars. And this time there's more of them. There's about 100 of them in this other half of your acreage. And Greg said, well, you know, doesn't it make sense that you just found and identified a caterpillar that's not light brown apple moth, yet, and it looks like the same caterpillar to me, you know, and now it's in the other half of my field. Wouldn't it make sense that it's the same caterpillar? So, you know, we can't do it that way. We have to quarantine your farm again, and we're going to close it down, and we'll get back to you in 10 days. Of course, another 3.5 weeks went by, and now they're into August. So, Greg, you know, if you know about strawberry production in Santa Cruz, July is it. That's when you're getting your best strawberries, and you're getting good price, and you've got great volume. So Greg was, in effect, shut down and lost, probably when you add it all up, about $40,000 to $50,000 worth of revenue, which for a small farm is it. That's everything. And the challenge for me is not just hearing about Greg's story, but because I'm in the produce industry and I have a wide view on the way produce is bought and sold in the United States, and especially in California, I see, for example, apples coming from New Zealand that are imported into the United States. And those farmers in New Zealand have light brown apple moth flying through their orchards every day. In New Zealand, they do not quarantine for the light brown apple moth. What they do instead is you bring your crop to the point where it's going to be inspected. It's inspected and then shipped to the United States. As long as it goes through the proper inspection process and has a form that enters it into the United States, there's no problem. So when I did some research on this, I realized that if you ship a container that contains about 86,000 apples, so it's about 18 to 20 pallets, 49 cases on a pallet, 88 to 100 apples per case, they only have to inspect, per my reading of the documentation that they've put online, they only have to inspect about 300 individual apples in that entire load. And my argument with this is, why are New Zealand apples allowed to be shipped into the United States really without the threat of quarantine, where we have domestic farmers that are quarantined every day because of the threat of light brown apple moth in this area? And to sort of further paint, my own concern and frustration with this, it's really our tax dollars, right, as citizens of the United States that are funding an agency that is working against our domestic producers of local and sustainable ag and giving benefit to international farmers. To me, that is wrong. And I find it highly concerning and something that needs to be addressed. So that is how I got involved.
Thank you. Thank you. And so on that, let's jump back over, Caroline, where we were talking earlier about what we know about these chemicals that have been proposed. So maybe we could talk a little bit about the chemicals and the inert ingredients. And Caroline and Roy, I know you both have a lot of information on that. So can we just talk a little bit about those chemicals, if you could?
Sure. So for me, the chemicals that are proposed for use in the apple moth program, the most important thing about it is really what we don't know about them rather than what we do know about them. So for those of you who are familiar with pesticides, you've probably heard that you can't use them unless the U.S. EPA says they're okay. And they're tested more than any other chemical. Well, let's just look at the pheromone that was the central chemical in the 2007 spraying and will continue to be used in the future plans for this program. EPA, when they looked at pheromones, waived all of the health and safety tests on this chemical. And they said, well, this is a mating pheromone, so we don't have any reason to expect that it would cause any problem, so we're going to waive all the tests. And there's kind of a catch-22 there, right? I mean, actually, pheromones are sort of a third-generation pesticide and supposed to not have the problems that some of the earlier chemicals did. However, if you don't test them, you're never going to know that for sure, right? The other issue is what are misleadingly called the inert ingredients in pesticides. So probably many of you know that most of the ingredients in a pesticide product are actually not publicly identified. Some of you may know that most of those unidentified chemicals are not included in most of the testing that's done on a pesticide. So when Roy and his neighbors were sprayed in Santa Cruz, they didn't actually know what they were sprayed with, and neither was there any official health and safety data to tell them what the effects of being exposed to that mixture of chemicals might be. So we're in a situation where we just don't know very much. And so when you propose to take a chemical with all these unknowns and spray it on, 10 million people, whatever, alarm bells start to go off. There's, something that doesn't quite seem right.
Yeah. Roy, comment on that too, but also I know you were involved in the trying to reclassify this. So if you could speak to both the chemicals and also the reclassification effort you were leading.
Sure. We looked at the, interestingly, the ingredients of Checkmate, which was sprayed, were accidentally released in the Santa Cruz Sentinel just by accident, literally by accident, because it was supposed to be proprietary information. And that's how we found out about what was in it. One of the compounds, tricapril methyl ammonium chloride, is so toxic that you're not even supposed to have any residues on conventional foods, let alone organic produce, and this stuff was approved for application to organic produce so that it wouldn't hurt the organic farmers, interestingly. The biggest thing on the safety side from my perspective is, to continue what Carol is saying, is that because EPA gave it a waiver, they exempted it from any safety testing whatsoever. Then it came to OEHAR, our Department of Health here in California, and to the Department of Pesticide Regulation, both of whom said EPA has given it a clean seal of approval, therefore it's safe. You see the catch-22 there? They exempted the product from safety testing, therefore the state health people said EPA says it is safe, no problem, we can spray this all over our babies, our old people, our children, our infirm, and we're going to do this every month for 7 years. There was no safety assessment on this whatsoever before this was sprayed and before it was planned to be sprayed almost throughout the entire state of California, because LBAM lives from Sonoma and has been found down as far down as San Diego now, L.A. and San Diego. That's the entire state of California, almost. And then when you look at some of the other compounds, actually a big part of the encapsulation was made up of urea, which is uric acid, which is like pee. But when that goes into seawater, that acts as an agent that can feed plankton that gives rise to red tide. After the spray, we had the worst red tide in the history of Santa Cruz in 25 years. To go back to the birds, the native plant, native animal rescue people said that with the worst red tide, they get maybe 25 birds submitted to them that were hurt by red tide. This was 230 in 3 days, and by about week 4 or 5, we had more than 700 dead birds, not injured birds, dead birds reported and found. When you look at the scientific literature and you say, when you have a fallout like this, you only find 10% of what was harmed. So that means there were more like 7,000 birds that were killed. What we also saw are not just the seabirds, but a gentleman lived at Pleasure Point for 30 years, and all he was a birder. He loved to watch the songbirds. He said after the week after the spray, there were no songbirds in his yard. And then at about day 8, he was walking his dog around the neighborhood and just seeing all these dead land birds. A woman down in Monterey was raising pygmy rabbits. If you know anything about pygmy rabbits, they're actually used to detect biochemical warfare because they're very sensitive respiratory-wise. She's been doing this for 15 or 18 years, never lost a litter. The day after, almost lost her entire litter. The week later, another one of her females miscarried. And that had never happened in 15 years. People with fish ponds, Jeff Hafferman, he's a councilman down in Monterey. His wife has a fish pond. Day after the spray, covered with a film of this yellow-green stuff, the next day all of her fish were dead. Somebody else, a dead goat. I had a working partner who had 3 cats. One of his cats got out during the spray and was covered with this spray and spent the next 2 or 3 days. They tried to towel him off, but the cat spent the next 2 or 3 days just constantly licking and licking, and third day he was dead. The other 2 cats that weren't exposed were fine. So this is just one after another of these safe pesticides. To get to the thing that drives programs like this is that a bug's name is on a list. Light brown apple moth. This is on a USDA hit list. Says if this comes into the country, then we have to go into action mode to try to eradicate it to get it out of the state or out of the country. And that's what they did. But when we went to New Zealand and talked to ag people there and Australia and Hawaii and in the United Kingdom, all of where LBAM has been naturalized. LBAM has been in Hawaii for 114 years. And they're saying, why are you asking us about LBAM, this nothing moth? The ag people are telling us this is going to destroy the precious redwoods and the cypresses and the oaks. And we go to the commissioner of forestry in New Zealand, and he says, L what? Light brown what? And it took them 3 hours to find somebody who knew what light brown apple moth was, and they had never heard of it affecting anything in native flora at all. Hawaii, the same thing. Yannick went out and called wineries in New Zealand, Australia, Hawaii. Same thing. Why are you asking us about this nothing insect? And so this is where we started the reclassification process, where we looked at all the scientific literature for more than 100 years, published in the ag journals all over the world. We talked to ag officials all over the world where LBAM was naturalized or native, and the consensus was this is easily managed in agricultural systems. Most of the things we use to control other more important pests also work for LBAM, and in most cases, and especially in organic systems, they hardly ever have to treat because natural predation is what keeps it at bay naturally without using any pesticide whatsoever. And let me just say one other thing is that light brown apple moth is a superficial leaf roller. You've all seen it. You go into your rose bushes and you see a leaf that's kind of folded in half and there's webbing in it. But it does nothing to the plant, to the actual health of the plant. It just rolls it, then it flits away, becomes part of the food chain. They're the moths that we see flitting around our porch lights every night that do nothing to anything. They're just background insects. So that's what this is. But because it was classified in the way that it was, they felt that they needed to eradicate it from the state. And to do that, they're going to put our health at jeopardy.
So moving into also talking about the farmers, and Chris, this brings up a point too about, so 2 years later, are farmers, what's happening to our farmers? Are they afraid? Are they, can they speak out? Can they, are they feeling better about this? Are they still under big threat?
Yeah, I think part of it is you know, farmers are generally so busy farming and doing their jobs every day that they're not often paying attention at a deep level, and I think they don't really understand the impact sometimes until it hits them. And I mean, that's been my personal experience with many of the farmers I've talked to, because I had the same experience that Roy did, which is, you know, hey, light brown apple moth, have you heard of this? Is this a problem? They're like, what are you talking about? If we're going to spray for anything, spray for codling moth, because that actually eats my fruit. Light brown apple moth doesn't do anything. And the farmers, I think, that we've worked with have only become aware of it then when they all of a sudden the quarantine area begins to expand and they start talking to other farmers that may have been quarantined. And they hear, well, wait a minute, quarantine means that if they find even one moth on my property, I can't sell my product that's harvested. Or, you know, I'm going to have a very difficult, you know, time in actually being sort of economically viable here. And that's when they start to take notice. And that's we're seeing more and more awareness now. And, you know, I'm concerned that this is kind of part of a broad, and I don't think it's premeditated at all, because that would be a theory that I just don't subscribe to. But I think it's an accidental sort of long-term creation of hindrances to sustainable agriculture in general that I think we have to be aware of and recognize and be very careful about, whether it's, you know, new regulations that may come out from the FDA around bringing small and local sustainable farms up to a level of food safety that's going to have to mirror sort of commercial agriculture, which is going to create huge capital intensive challenges for small farms, or whether it's light brown apple moth that's creating huge economic hindrances for small farmers just to do things in an organic and sustainable way. These are things that when you add them all up together and you take a look at the trend, it's going to force sustainable and small local agriculture into a box that they're not able to get out of. And that's that's where I see somebody like Preston over at, you know, Kaiser. And when Preston and I met originally, he was, you know, continuing thinking about how do you solve this problem of bringing small, sustainable, and local organic farmers to people so that people can, you know, take part in that and bolster that economic movement as well. And I just don't want these legal or structural or, you know, quarantine things that end up hindering these farmers from taking hold. So. Yeah.
Preston, and that dovetails nicely to you because in terms of the farmers, and your patients in your hospital, that are you seeing what kinds of partnerships are you seeing arise there? Are you hearing new things? Are more farmers saying things to you? Are patients saying things to you? Are they glad that they have this opening for this kind of produce? Or just the kinds of things that you're hearing from now, all 38, is it, 38 markets?
Well, as I said before, good food is the foundation of preventive health. And preventive health is what I think the future of healthcare needs to be, and it's certainly the kind of work that goes on in my healthcare system. In good food is not just food that has certain micronutrients, of so much lycopene and so much omega-3s and all this. And I personally, while all that's very important, I look more just at the general principles. If you're going to have good food that goes beyond the micronutrients, it's got to be good for you, it's got to be good for your kids, it's got to be sustainable in terms of how it's grown as far as the earth is concerned. But it's also best if it's good for the farm workers. There's more and more information available these days on the impacts of organophosphate pesticides used in agriculture on farm workers and their children. A colleague at the University of California in Berkeley runs a program called CHAMUCOS. It's the Comprehensive Health Assessment of the Mothers and Children of Salinas. She and her, Dr. Brenda Eskenazi and her staff are studying now over 600 children, some of whom are up to 9 years old, that are born to farm workers. And she's looked very carefully at the various levels of metabolites of pesticides on the farm workers, on their children, looking back at levels in amniotic fluid and cord blood in the children's urine as they grow, and studying them very carefully for impacts on their health. I'm not going to go into details now, but there are adverse impacts that are statistically significantly related to levels of pesticide exposure in some of these children. And it's not just her studies that show this. There's another university on the other coast doing similar studies that are coming up with the same findings. UCSF's Center for Reproductive Health put out an excellent white paper last year about the impacts of pesticides and other toxics on reproductive health, and looked at miscarriages and fertility and birth defects, and also at childhood cancers, and looked at all kinds of things. It's an excellent comprehensive study, and the basic summary statement out of all that work, when speaking to practitioners who are involved in reproductive health, is, you know, talk to your patients about what kind of chemicals they're using in their home, what kind of chemicals they're using for their personal hygiene, what kind of chemicals are on the food they eat, because all those things matter. Now, we all in this room of any age are loaded with all kinds of industrial chemicals at this point. I mean, one of my colleagues, a leader in the environmental stewardship at Kaiser Permanente, got tested just for a good slide for talking points that makes the point. She had the basic 27 industrial chemicals in her, including DDT. Now, DDT was outlawed in 1972. She still got it in her body. And if she's got it, I've got it. and, you know, two, and running behind the trucks in the East Coast. It's likely present in all of us. I can't say as I sit here that those levels of chemicals in our body are doing specifically something to me, and my die might be cast. I mean, I'm 65. What I'm concerned about are the children, you know, for the future, who are yet to even be conceived, mm-hmm. and where our efforts, I think, really need to be is at the preconceptional phase, you know, to get through to young women and to young men before pregnancy ever happens. And that's really our prime time for making a difference. A good, healthy diet of organically grown foods, avoidance of substance abuse, the basic premises of good health at that age will change the future. And, you know, that while we're specifically talking about the light brown apple moth tonight, it's a great example of the broader picture and the complexities of the broader picture.
Yeah, if I could chime in on something. A lot of us, I was in a congressional hearing in, I think it was in 1992, and it was a congressional hearing on pesticides because there had just been a study of the, you know, of children reaching their maximum allowable amounts of many of these agrochemicals by the age of six. This was in 1992, so this is not a new story. But what really piqued my interest in this congressional hearing was that they said that the majority of the pesticides that were being used were not designed to kill bugs. They were designed to create a high rate of reproductive failure in the bug population so that they would have miscarriages, so they would be infertile, and because they're endocrine disruptors. So a lot of them are estrogen-based, and we wonder why women have 1 in 8 in this country, 1 in 8 rate of breast cancer, men 1 in 8 or 1 in 9 prostate cancer. It's the same mechanism. But why is it that women in rural China is 1 in 30, Japan 1 in 15, 1 in 18 in many Asian countries? And then when they come here and start to eat the foods that we have here, their rate of breast cancer exactly meets the 1 in 8 within a few years. This is not a mystery. It's not in the water, and it's not something that's new news. But it is. LBM is a microcosm of the way that USDA, CDFA, and all of our agriculture officials, most of them, not all, but most, manage our food supply in a very, very insidious way. Because of the E. coli breakout of spinach, which happened in Santa Cruz a number of years ago, they're moving toward the sterilization of our food supply, trying to get rid of everything that can cause anything, when they should be doing the exact opposite and creating a healthy biological system that naturally prevents invasions of pests and pathogens. But this is not what we're doing. We tend to be overreactive as a country. And as Chris said, I don't think it's malicious, but it is institutionalized ignorance that this is how they've been taught. They've been taught this in school, not to think biologically, but to think bug, bad, kill. Not create a healthy environment that will produce a healthy food. And everything that we're doing in the mass market of food production is leading toward human health degradation and environmental health degradation, and it will impact our future generations more than us, because it's builds up over generations and time. Mm-hmm. It's not a mystery, and we have to do something about this. And I think voting with our fork is the single best way. And it's kind of interesting that we're actually, the government is moving toward this sanitization of our food supply, but organics is the number one growing category in the food market, mm-hmm. in this country. So there's an odd juxtaposition, mm-hmm. of events going on where our bureaucrats are way, way behind the times, but our consumer base is catching up with reality. We have to do that a little faster.
Anybody that would like to ask a question, if you'd line up over here at the microphone, we want to make sure we capture that on the mic. And Preston.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about the statistics about breast cancer, prostate cancer, and so forth. While those incidence rates are in the range of the incidence rates with which I'm familiar also, I don't know that we can say, I mean, it's a very complex issue, and I don't know that we can imply that it's just related to pesticides in foods. I think it's a multifactorial problem.
Absolutely.
Okay. I had one thing to add as well, that one of the things that's also a misconception, I think, sometimes about organics, and I think should be clarified for the public and people should understand this, is that there are organic pesticides that are used. Organic farms can put pesticides on their product that are classified as organic pesticides. And I think that, you know, one of the things I'm personally interested in, and the reason I think, you know, at Fruit Guys and myself personally, we want to have more of a personal relationship with farmers is because we actually want to know exactly what they're doing, you know, rather than taking it for granted that, you know, this is something that's quote-unquote organic. And I think that's part of this problem, too, with light brown apple moth or any of these issues is that, you know, the definition of what it really is versus how it's classified or what it says it is, you have to kind of understand that difference a little bit.
Okay, thank you.
We're not. Okay, there we go. Okay, I'd like to remind our listening audience at home, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the Commonwealth Club. Our program tonight is Moth Spray Controversy Update, narrated by Christy Dames. And now we're going to turn it over for questions and answers.
I have a question for Roy. How was LBAM classified as a major pest in the first place, and how's the reclassification effort going?
It was originally, it ended up on a pesticide restriction list in 1984. And what I've been told by people who have been in meetings like that, groups of agricultural people get together and say, what bugs are over here but aren't over here? And so this is why how we have to develop our restriction list. Now, there might also be specific trade issues. So, for example, New Zealand was just coming on in the early 1980s, it was just coming on with apple production, and whether or not and citrus production, and whether or not that created some type of trade advantage to restrict them from coming here because of the potential for LBAM. It took them probably a good 25 years to develop good integrated pest management programs to control for LBAM to a degree that the USDA would readily accept. So there might be trade issues, but basically it was arbitrarily put on a list because it was over there on crops, but it wasn't over here. At least to our knowledge, it wasn't over here. As far as the reclassification efforts go, they were denied. USDA denied our petition for reclassification, but this is a little bit interesting story, is that they denied our petition for reclassification, and they submitted their response to our petition to the National Academy of Science and asked the National Academy of Science to tell them if they addressed the issues that we raised adequately. The National Academy of Science review consisted of USDA people, entomology experts, agricultural experts around the world, and they came back with one of the most scathing reviews of USDA's science, basically saying, no, they did not do a thorough and balanced review of the petitions. Natural Resource Defenses Council, Margaret Reeves here, they also put in a petition, and that's how they answered that they have not done a thorough and balanced review of the petitions, that the science that they used to project their economic loss due to LBAM were flawed and in some cases inaccurate, that in some cases their science was incomprehensible, and that they would do well in reviewing other alternatives to eradication and other management practices similar to those that are already employed in New Zealand and other countries where LBAM exists but is not an agricultural problem. So as far as now is concerned, this time frame, there is no reclassification on the table because they've already denied that petition. The only hope that I could see that they could stop this program could be stopped And as Carol said, being a control program, this means it goes on forever and ever, amen, in our communities. And that means potentially spraying in our communities and putting this stuff on telephone poles around our communities. In Santa Cruz, they projected 2,000 telephone poles per square mile to put this pesticide pheromone splat on telephone poles. So this is a very real invasion of our communities with something that we don't know the long-term and residual effects of. But as of now, the only way that I can see that this program can stop is with the lawsuit against USDA.
Mm. Another question?
Good evening, Dr. Sandy Ross. I have two comments and a question. Regarding endocrine disruption, what you've said, Roy, is very true. And in fact, Theo Colburn of the Endocrine Disruption Exchange, TEDX, has an excellent video on their website. You can also get it. It's called The Male Predicament. And, Chris, I was really laughing. I always think about how are you going to get that little LBAM to roll up a redwood frond to make a sleeping bag. My main question is for Caroline, and it has to do with the twist ties. We know that one of their ways of getting the pheromone out, now that they presumably aren't going to be doing the aerial spraying, is to put lots and lots of twist ties on people's trees. Now, they're supposed to saturate the air for 30 days, so in some ways it's going to be worse in the field than it would be on the 3 days a month spraying. And how do we get people to understand that not only is this looming, but it could be very, very bad for their health, and to protect us all, for the children, ourselves, and everyone. Thank you.
Maybe we should quickly just say what a twist tie is for folks that don't know. So the idea is that this is the sex attractant pheromone of the apple moth, and what you're trying to do is confuse the males so it can't find the females. So you want to get the pheromone in the air everywhere so the males are wandering around in a daze instead of heading for the females. So the pheromone is, synthetic version of the pheromone is put in little twist ties that are sort of like the thing that you use to close a plastic bag, but not really. And you can just twist those around the branch of a tree or wherever you want to put them, and they slowly release the pheromone over a period of time. And I think that there's no question that airplanes flying overhead, no matter what they're spraying, is a major disruption of our lives. My youngest daughter was born while eradication helicopters flew over the roof of my house, and I can say that it has an impact on your life. and a little twist tie on a tree is probably never going to have that same kind of impact that airplanes flying overhead day after day after day is going to have. But I think that there's things that people do understand. People do understand that our government shouldn't be spending $75 million if there's no reason to be doing this. I think people do understand that a control program with no end in sight maybe needs to be rethought. People definitely understand about the lack of information that we have about these chemicals, that there's so much we don't know. Inert ingredients are a great example of that. I think one of the things that people are so aware of right now, I mean, when DDT was first used, people didn't understand that it could cause birds not to be able to lay healthy eggs. And if you had said that, you know, sort of out loud in 1955 or something, you'd probably get laughed off the stage or whatever. And the history of pesticide use is like that. Every 5-10 years, there's a new problem that no one had thought of before, and up it comes. So you know, maybe at this point we don't have a smoking gun to point at these twist ties, but what we do know is that pesticides are chemicals that are designed to kill or harm living things. There's enough similarities between us and an apple moth that, you know, I think we all worry about that. And some of us are willing to use the pesticides because we see that there's some kind of a benefit. But in the case of the apple moth, the benefits are so ambiguous and so uncertain that I think many, many, many people would agree that it's just not worth it. Even if we don't have a smoking gun, to subject ourselves to this chemical when there's really nothing that we have to gain from it.
What we have to know is that they have the legal authority, to walk into your yard and put these up all over your yard. And at Jared Huffman's hearing a few years ago, he asked, what are we talking about? Are we talking about onesies and twosies? The ag guy says, no, think of a Christmas tree, of the number that would be in the yard. But don't worry, you'll get used to it. It'll be just like walking over your dog that you do every day. You won't even notice it after a week. You know, these are by the thousands in every one of our yards. And again, I'm with Carolyn. There's no smoking gun on twist ties, but the unknown's always worse than, you know, is the worst part of it.
I want to add just one comment about what we can do to try to get people interested in this issue and help inform them and help put pressure in a way that actually can make a real change. I'm going to say something that could, you know, offend large groups of people, but I'll say it anyway because I'm from Northern California and I will offend myself by saying it. But, you know, I worry sometimes that if you take only an environmental approach or only a health approach, that it can come off as, you know, just imagine what Fox News would say. They would say, oh, those wacko Northern California, you know, they're drinking kombucha and, you know, not wearing socks, right? And that's, you know, somehow, you know, a reason for putting the idea down. But what they can't say, and what I worry about, what I've heard sort of the counter-argument being is, well, we need to spray because it's going to help industry. But if we can actually take that argument and say, actually, because there's a discrepancy in trade policy between what we're allowing New Zealand farmers to do versus us suppressing our own domestic farmers here, and we're actually spending tax dollars to hurt our own domestic farmers and give actual, you know, some sort of better preference to those international farmers, then that argument can't be taken away. And I think that one of the things, I find that as a lowest common denominator argument, to be honest, and saying, yes, there are the health issues, there's the environmental issues, all those things, but there's also this trade issue that our government should not be supporting. And that's something that I think is something that anybody from any political spectrum can generally understand.
Yeah, beautiful.
For the specific chemicals that are in the Checkmate that was sprayed over Santa Cruz and Monterey, what is known about how long a period of time those chemicals stay in the environment after they're sprayed, and how far do these chemicals work their way into the food chain? And one more thing I'd be curious to know is if the chemicals do, in fact, work their way into the food chain, what is the potential for those chemicals working their way the whole way into species that we consume, edible animals and plants that we consume? Could we end up with Checkmate chemicals in foods that we buy at the grocery store eventually? I'd like to know what the potential is, if anyone studied it.
I think the Checkmate product was designed to be effective for 30, 60, or 90 days. So that's the time period that the people who developed the product planned for it to be able to persist in the environment.
For the pheromone portion of it.
One of the things that becomes really obvious if you study the nerdy stuff about pesticides for a long time is that how long something lasts in the environment is incredibly variable. So under certain kinds of conditions, it might last for 3 days. under other kinds of conditions, the exact same collection of chemicals might last for 6 months. And it depends on so many things, temperature, light, weather conditions, and you can just go on and on and on. So I think that the answers to your questions are probably really difficult to give accurate answers to. But I think what you're getting at is, are these things becoming part of our environment and part of us? And I think what we can say from our experience in the last 50 years of using synthetic pesticides is yes. I mean, look at pesticides right now. The U.S. Geological Survey goes out and samples water all across the country, and they find pesticides in virtually every sample that they take. If you look at air across the country, somewhere between 60 and 70% of air samples that get taken in monitoring programs have pesticides in them. When the USDA tests food for pesticide residues, about 60, 70%, somewhere in there, of the samples that they test have pesticides. So our sort of pesticide addiction, if that's what you want to call it, means that pesticides are everywhere.
One more question here. Great.
First, my name is Margaret Reeves from the Pesticide Action Network, and I want to thank all the panelists. This has really been an excellent forum, and thank you to Commonwealth Club. Just one comment I wanted to make. Again, thanks for bringing up all the myriad issues here. And the question about trade is not at all a trivial one. And I just wanted to mention that one of the arguments given from USDA is that, well, if we don't quarantine, then we risk trade relationships with our partners, Mexico and Canada, for example. And some communications with individuals in the relevant departments in Mexico and Canada have indicated, in fact, that if the U.S. were to change its position vis-a-vis LBAM and quarantine, that, in fact, they would be willing, or at least there would certainly be a possibility for discussion of them changing their trade policies. So it's not an absolute certainty that if we do not respond, then we are just out of those important trade partners. But those issues are really, really important. Thank you.
Yeah, to say that the United States is the largest market that people want to ship produce into is going to somehow not be a leader in trade policy around these things is, you know, living in a naive world. So that's, yeah. Thank you. That's a great point.
We specifically talked to agricultural experts in Australia who confirmed that they can ship anywhere in the world without any problem whatsoever with regards to LBM or any of the other leaf rollers that they have. So Margaret's point is exactly right on, is that this was somebody's bad dream within CDFA or USDA to do this type of program when they really didn't need to. They can develop the same types of trade agreements that New Zealand and Australia have been working with for 30 years and be able to ship anywhere in the world with the same type of inspections that are in New Zealand now, which if you're looking at the actual integrated pest management literature, says is as best cost neutral and in many cases saves money because you actually save money on buying pesticides that you no longer need because you're developing a natural system with natural predators in a healthy system.
There's no eradication. There's no quarantine.
Right.
So it's.
Yeah. We have one last audience question. I'm going to ask one final question to wrap it up. And
was one thing we haven't brought up, and that's the irradiated moths. My husband's an entomologist. Yeah. In talking with him and his colleagues, I want to tell you that the female LBAM is not going to go for the sort of weak, wimpy, irradiated guy with a big orange dot on his back. Plus the fact that the female mates and mates and mates until she's inseminated. So they could put any number of irradiated moths out there, and it's not going to do it. She's going to find what she needs.
This is an important point because the other part of this program is what's called sterile insect technique, where they are irradiating LBM, breeding them by the millions and irradiating them, making them infertile, supposedly, and then going to release those into the environment. Now, there actually are studies where you feed cats irradiated cat food, and they get sick and sick and get leukemia and things like that. And so one of the risks that we face is the birds and the bats, which are two of the primary natural predators of LBAM, along with spiders and flies. Everything eats LBAM. It's like spam, really, is what it is. But to release literally billions of irradiated moths into our environment without any environmental impact review on that, to me, is incomprehensible as well. But that is their newest strategy for controlling LBAM, along with coming into our yards with all their pesticides.
Wow. So indeed, we still have some work to do then, what I'm hearing. So what I'd like to do in wrapping this up is I'd like for each of you to briefly say the partnership that you see happening, whether it's between you and someone else, or a partnership you've seen, one that you see that's new and working, and one that you'd really like to see happen. What is if there was the partnership of people coming together of your dreams, what would that look like? So just quickly, we'll start with you, Caroline. We'll go around this way and end with you, Roy.
So I actually have three different partnerships that I want to talk about, but I'll try to be really quick.
Yeah, we need to be.
One is that environmental impact report that I mentioned several times is a subject of litigation right now, and it's an exciting partnership because it involves both, you know, some of the community groups that form to oppose the Apple Moth program, as well as sort of larger and more established environmental groups, as well as the cities of Albany, Richmond, and Berkeley. So there's a great partnership there. Another great partnership that I've been involved with, it directly grew out of the concerns about these inert ingredients in apple moth pesticides. Right now, amazingly enough, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has said it's going to look at options for disclosing more information about these unidentified chemicals. And here in California, taking positions in support of that process, we have the California Attorney General, the California Assembly, the California Senate, OEHA, which is the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, California Department of Public Health, as well as a string of other organizations. I mean, I could keep going for a really long time. So that's another really exciting partnership. And then the last thing I wanted to mention was that I think it's come up a few times here that really over time that 160 million pounds of pesticides that are used in California every year, the people who bear the biggest burden of that pesticide use are people who either work in agriculture or live in agricultural communities. And in 2002, the state gave counties the right to set up protection zones around schools to protect kids from pesticides. And this year, there is a bill in the legislature to make those protections statewide. And because of the bringing in urban people from across the state, instead of that bill just coming from agricultural areas, actually the author of the bill was from Oakland. And we had the California PTA and the California Nurses Association and a number of other organizations like that supporting the bill. So when you asked about partnerships of our dreams, that one, like the bill did not succeed, but the partnership of my dreams would be that partnership would grow and get that bill through the legislature next year.
Nice. Thank you. Chris?
Well, on the farmer side, I mean, we're really happy that the farmers that we work with are responding positively to this and getting more and more involved. We think that's a good sign, and we think it's a very sign of a healthy democracy, too, you know, and a, mm-hmm. and a participatory one. So we're happy about that. You know, our partnership with Preston and with Kaiser has been one around sustainable agriculture and not necessarily directly related to LBAM, but mm-hmm. sustainability in general, which I think is a wonderful thing to see that, you know, large organizations are moving in a direction of changing the world, mm-hmm. and that we can be part of that is a real honor. So with that, I'll pass it to you.
I mean, the partnerships I'd like to see in my dreams are at a personal level. First, I'd like to see in each family partnerships of us with our chef's knives, two cutting boards, and a salad spinner. I think that those may be some of the most important public health tools we have. Second, I'd like to see partnerships of parents and their kids and teaching the kids how to cook early on. And then lastly, I guess if I could think big, it would be that we'd have way more than just 3% of the food eaten in this country be grown in a way that's good for us, good for our kids, good for the earth, and good for the people that grow it. Right now it is 3%. If we could push that up, if we created the demand and each of us partnered with the farmers that grow our food, then we'd be talking about food sheds, regional food sheds that would coalesce into a larger national food shed. And but those are the partnerships I'd like to see for the long term.
Wow. Thank you.
For me, it's people, people, and people. What I learned from LBAM is that it was individual peoples that stopped the eradication. It was individual people that stopped the spraying. It wasn't entrenched bureaucracies. It wasn't entrenched organizations with long history of environmental activism. It was new groups popping up just out of commitment, dedication, love of environment, love of human health. Love of individual, you know, as far as the right to health, which we are protected by the Constitution of California to attain is the right of health. That's what really stopped this. There's only two ways to affect the, in my opinion, two primary ways to affect the legislative world, and that is with a lot of voters or a lot of money. None of us are going to have a lot of money to throw at the politicians. And the political process, what we can do is generate a lot of bodies, a lot of impassioned mothers, and I see the partnership as being mothers, fathers, aunts, uncles, and children, and putting our children at the center to say, we can't allow this to happen to these kids. Where we have the responsibility to protect our children, and we can't allow this to happen. And if we really own that responsibility, that we have stewardship with the earth,